We got a crash course in recent years about pollinators. It's not like pollination is anything new to nature, but events like the mass bee die-off at a shopping center in the Portland area a few years ago snapped a lot of people to attention. Now we know more about how much of our food supply depends upon the work of bees and other pollinators, and how sensitive those pollinators are to things like pesticides. Pesticides will be among the subjects at an all-day session at the Extension Center in Jackson County on Saturday called Protecting Pollinators, Benefits for Ecosystems and Food Security in Oregon. Both keynote speakers join us. Dr. Susan Kegley is with the Pesticide Research Institute. Dr. Kegley, good to talk to you. Are you there? Perhaps not. Ame Code is with us, I believe. She is the Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation based in the Portland area. Ame, are you here? Okay, we're going to see if we can get Dr. Kegley back on the line. So one of the things you'll be talking about this week in your keynote address is you'll be talking about the title of your address is Mounting Evidence of Harm, Neonicotinoid Contamination of Our Waters. Let's talk about neonicotinoids generally. How long have they been on the scene and what kinds of effects do we see from them? That's for you, Ame. Okay, turn up line six. There we go. Ame, are you there? Okay. Did you hear the question?
I started to. I think you wanted to know a little bit more about the concerns we have with neonicotinoids in water.
Neonicotinoids, yes, indeed.
Well, you know, obviously, when we're talking about water quality, there is an amazing array of contaminants and an amazing array of issues that we're dealing with to make sure that we have water. And in order to be able to manage it, we sometimes need to prioritize. And neonicotinoids are one of those priorities. Looking at our waters are a great indicator for broader environmental health. And neonicotinoids are really long-lived, and they're extremely toxic to a number of the foundational species that our ecosystems need to survive. The insects that fish and birds are going to be eating, the mayflies that are going to be breaking down leaf matter. Maybe it doesn't seem very important that a mayfly, you know, would break down leaf matter until you start thinking about, you know, what's happening to the river health if you don't have those species there. So, at the Xerces Society, we are focused on invertebrates and think of them as the foundation of all of our life, and so we're watching to see what's happening to them, and we're very concerned about neonicotinoids in water because they're just so widely used and so very persistent.
Were neonicotinoids substitutes for other pesticides that were considered nastier, Ame?
This is the reality of the world of pesticides and why we need to be thinking big picture. You know, I think we became very aware of the concerns with silent spring when Rachel Carson brought forth the concerns of organochlorines like DDT. We got rid of the organochlorines and we put in organophosphates. You know, we realized that, oh my gosh, those are harmful to our children, they're harmful to our fish, there's all kinds of concerns we're phasing some of those uses out.
Okay, Ame, let me bring Susan in here because I think we have her on the line. Dr. Susan Kegley, are you there? From Pesticide Research Institute? I hear motion. I don't hear people. I'm going to put her back on hold. Let me take that off. So, Ame, we're going to have to deal with you. We're not hearing you very well. If there's any way you can get closer to the phone, that would help the process a little bit. Have we been through cycles before, Ame, of casting off clearly harmful pesticides in favor of what we thought were safer ones?
I think that, unfortunately, is very much the treadmill we are on. There's a list of chemicals, one to the next. And something that's so important is changing our overall systems. In agriculture, that means more biodiversity. And, you know, not reaching for that pesticide is your first option. In the urban area, it means, you know, maybe we need to change what we think of as aesthetic. What's wrong with a few nibbles out of the leaf on a plant in your garden? What's wrong with a few more insects around? We seem to like sterile environments, and we need to shift that. So, yes, unfortunately, we do have this treadmill, and we need to change how we're thinking in order to be able to get off that treadmill.
Is it as simple as you say, though, that it really is a lot about how things look when we're talking about gardening and maintaining nice landscapes? Is it people just want to make sure that their leaves look unchewed by aphids and things like that?
Well, of course it's not simple. Words are so much easier than actions. It's going to really be a whole new way of approaching our gardens or a new way of approaching agriculture. So if we're talking about agriculture, you know, the Xerces Society has staff that are out there in the field working with farmers to bring back beneficial insects that actually can help manage pest problems, to create systems that break pest cycles. Maybe that's crop rotation or putting in a beetle bank where beneficial beetles are going to be coming out into your field and eating your slugs. It's a slow process, but it's absolutely important. And in our backyard, I think it is a lot easier. I mean, honestly, rarely have the pests in my garden got to a place where I no longer have kale. I just have a few aphids, and I can wash them off with water, with a stream of water. We're not talking about an economic loss in our backyard in the same way.
All right. We will move to a break right now. We're talking about the pesticides and pollinators with Ame Code, who is the Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And I think we have now back online Dr. Susan Kegley at the Pesticide Research Institute. We will be talking to them both. They are going to be the keynote speakers at a session coming up next weekend in the Rogue Valley called Protecting Pollinators, Benefits for Ecosystems and Food Security in Oregon. You'll hear more about the broader range of things being talked about between pesticides and pollinators and all the other interrelations there, a lot of them unwelcome. We'll come back and talk more with Ame Code and Dr. Susan Kegley when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about pesticides and pollinators today. They will be the discussion topics listed among several at a session coming up this weekend of the Rogue Valley called Protecting Pollinators, Benefits for Ecosystems and Food Security in Oregon. We have two of the two keynote speakers with us. Ame Code, you've been hearing in the first segment, is the Pesticide Program Director for the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. And Dr. Susan Kegley is from the Pesticide Research Institute. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Kegley, we had a few phone issues so far. Are you with us now? Dr. Susan Kegley? Wow, there's a massive problem with the phones with Dr. Kegley today. So Ame Code, back to you once again. I know you're about invertebrates, but what can you tell us about the neonicotinoid effects up the food chain?
You broke off for a second. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
I know that the Xerces Society is about invertebrate conservation, but what can you tell us about the effects of neonicotinoids as they go up the food chain?
Sure. Well, I also want to take a step back because we're talking about pollinators today, and I want to bring the audience also to the idea that we have a lot more pollinators out there than our honeybees. So let's make sure we get back to that too.
Sure.
But you know, when we're talking about neonicotinoids, they're going to be affecting that base of that, you know, that food web. And we see cascading effects. So if you lose your mayflies, I mean, who eats the mayflies? Well, the fly fishermen know that because we're going to be impacting trout and salmon, steelhead. There's all kinds of many, many bird species that either as young or throughout their life are going to be reliant on insect species. So we're going to be changing our whole the dynamic if we are going to be losing the bottom of the food chain. And of course, pollinators, about almost 90% of our plants require an insect or other pollinator in order to be able to reproduce. So we would be losing our plants. That's seeds for our birds. That's, you know, our berries, our fruits. It's not just food for humans. It's food for everyone if we lose our pollinators.
And what was that percentage again?
It's about 89% of all plants require some sort of pollinator in order to be able to reproduce.
Okay, something other than the wind or just other, you know, not a third party, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So when you talk about pollinators, to make sure that we understand they're more than just bees, why don't you go ahead and expand the scope for us there?
Well, we start with honeybees. Everyone knows the honeybee. They're an amazing colony, this super organism where you can have 50,000 bees all together. And, you know, the honeybee was brought over from Europe. But we also have thousands of species of bees here in the United States, about 600 to 800 species in Oregon. And those are our bumblebees. And they're these wonderful little solitary bees that we have. And a single female will replenish her nest. And they don't produce honey, but they're vitally important, even in agriculture or in our own yard. And what's lovely about them is you just can create habitat and they will come. A lot less work than trying to have a honeybee colony in your yard. So that, and then of course, take another step out and we've got our butterflies and wasps and flies and you know, hummingbirds, so many other pollinators. But bees are the core because a bee, all of their food comes from flowers. So unlike a wasp or a hummingbird that's going to be eating other food sources, bees only require the flowers. And so they're going to be really the most efficient of pollinators.
We're talking pollinators and pesticides with Ame Code from the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation. Dr. Susan Kegley should be joining us as well from the Pesticide Research Institute. Susan, are you there? Susan Kegley? Wow. That's amazing what's going on there. Ame, you were about
to
say something?
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say I'm sorry that Susan can't be on the phone. She is really an amazing scientist who has been doing a lot of research into the impacts the pesticides have on pollinators. I know a big concern of hers is that it isn't always obvious that a pesticide is a problem. For example, there's a lot of fungicides. You know, they're used mm-hmm. to control things like powdery mildew in your yard or on the farm. And they're listed as practically non-toxic to pollinators. Well, her research and the research of other scientists is putting that in question. You might call it practically non-toxic, but the complex systems that we're in, those bees are still seeing significant impacts to their health because of fungicides. And I think that those subtle effects are what we really need to be focused on. You mentioned the horrific bee kill up in Wilsonville, where hundreds of bumblebee colonies were devastated, all because of a single application. And that's not the only one. But what's insidious is this use every day, all the time, that's getting into our waters, that's moving through our systems. And maybe we don't even realize something like a fungicide, because it says it's practically non-toxic, is still affecting our bee populations. Again, that's why we take a step back, find ways not to use these chemicals, look for another solution.
All right, wow, it's just so much to talk about here. In the environment generally, do neonicotinoids, you talked about the water, but you know, is there a general sense of the life of a neonicotinoid and how long it hangs around on water, land, air?
Well, there's about 10 answers to that, but so there's a number of neonicotinoids. There's more than one, and they have different half-lives, and they act differently in the soil compared to the water. But if you're talking about some of the chemicals that are being used and are on the rise, like clothianidin and imidacloprid, we're talking about chemicals that can be detected in plants, in soil, months to years after an application. Years after an application, you're still finding amounts, levels in pollen and nectar. And of course, that's a direct route to our pollinators.
You say years after an application. Are they being used correctly in these applications?
Or as labeled,
I guess we should say, as directed?
You know, yes. Most of these studies that we're looking at are studies that use the chemical according to the label. And there was actually a study done by industry. So the company that sells the chemicals, there's a few out there. And I believe it was Bayer, but I'm not sure which company. 6 years after an application to a rhododendron, you could still detect the chemical in the pollen and nectar.
Wow.
6 years. And up in Wilsonville, there were fines levied, but that was actually, the label was not violated. The applicator was negligent, but not because he applied it, you know, the same day as bees might be out, but he actually did follow the label. So that's concerning, too. Thousands of bees were killed. Hundreds of colonies devastated.
We tried Susan Kegley on a different phone. I wonder if she can hear us now. Dr. Susan Kegley from the Pesticide Research Institute?
I can just barely hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Okay, good to talk to you at last. Can you tell us a bit about the Pesticide Research Institute and what you do and who hires you?
I can't hear that well enough. I can hear Mae when she talks.
Okay.
But maybe I could address one of the questions that you brought up earlier, which is what happens up the food chain? And it turns out that we humans are exposed in our food supply on a very regular basis to these neonicotinoid chemicals. The studies done by the USDA to look at the pesticide residues in the food supply find it predominantly, or these pesticides are found predominantly in peppers, tomatoes, squash, and lettuce. And so there's lots of potential routes for exposure. The exposures are low. The residue detections are not screening off scale. But there's starting to be some work done on potential effects on mammals like humans. Studies in Japan show an interesting result of weed or insect management in their forests. They were combating an insect pest and were using lots of imidacloprid in their forest. And one of the doctors in the emergency room there noticed a number of people coming in with cardiac arrhythmias, finger tremors, and problems with short-term memory. So she started to look into it and found that they had been involved in pest management in the forest. And then she started tracking these kinds of symptoms over time. And even after the invasive pest management program was over, she still saw people coming in with these symptoms. And in Japan, the allowable residue levels on food and in tea are higher than what we allow in the U.S. So people were being exposed to more. And so she did some nice work showing that there appeared to be a correlation, and there needs to be more work done for sure, but there appeared to be a correlation between exposure to these compounds and that trio of symptoms with finger tremor, cardiac arrhythmias, and short-term memory loss. So there are also a few research papers that show effects on reproduction, but we're just starting to learn about the effects on mammals in more detail. As Amé said, the pollinator work is very extensive and is unquestionable that these pesticides are problematic for pollinators.
We are talking about pesticides and pollinators here on the Jefferson Exchange with a couple of the two keynote speakers who will be speaking this weekend at a conference in the Rogue Valley called Protecting Pollinators, Benefits for Ecosystems and Food Security in Oregon. Amé Code is the Pesticide Program Director at the Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation based in the Portland area. Dr. Susan Kegley is with the Pesticide Research Institute. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number here is 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Dr. Kegley, if you can hear me, are there believed to be levels at which neonicotinoids are considered quote unquote safe in the human diet?
Well, certainly EPA conducts its risk assessment of any new pesticide to make that determination. What level is, and I wouldn't use the word safe. They don't use the word safe, acceptable, and they do a risk-benefit analysis on this. So it doesn't have to be perfectly safe to be approved. It has to, the benefits have to outweigh the risks. And the problem with the system like that for registering pesticides is the people who get the benefit don't take the risks, per se. So, the farmers are getting the benefit and the people who are exposed take the risk. So it's not a perfect system. But, for the number of studies required for registration, it looks like these pesticides are not particularly acutely toxic, meaning immediately toxic to people. And they were a vast improvement over some of the older pesticides in that regard. So workers are getting fewer acute poisons from working with these chemicals in the field. But we don't know enough yet about the chronic effects or the low dose effects that might be arising from these chemicals.
Is there anything potentially looming on the market that could replace neonicotinoids and do essentially their job but be less of concern?
Well, the nursery growers, this is interesting because we, working with Friends of the Earth, my company, Pesticide Research Institute, helped look at the levels of these pesticides in garden plants. And once consumers, we found, half the plants had measurable levels of these pesticides in pollinator attractive flowers. So we also then, Friends of the Earth followed up with Home Depot and tried to work with them to see if they could get these chemicals out of their products. And the nurseries that grow the flowers for the big box stores were stepping up to the plate. So the next year after we did the first report, we did a survey of the nurseries to see what they were doing. And instead of turning to yet another chemical, many successful nurseries were looking at biological controls. So releasing ladybugs or lacewings or assassin bugs into their greenhouses to go after the pests. As one of the nursery people said, there's you can't be resistant to being eaten. Because with any pesticide, you have the problem of the bugs becoming resistant, but they can't get resistant to being eaten by something else. So I found that to be very encouraging, and that's the solution. It's different than our typical pest management paradigm that we've hewed to for so many years, but it is the wave of the future, and I think that is the way we should be going.
Let's take a call. We're talking to Susan Kegley and Ame Code here on the Jefferson Exchange about pesticides and pollinators. Here's Ginger and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, thank you. I live next to an orchard, a pear orchard in Talent. For many years I've lived there, and I observe every year that they place the beehives in the middle of the orchard during pollination times. However, they continue to spray, and I've always wondered how they can possibly get away with that. Whatever it is they're spraying, I don't know, but it's a big question for me.
Ame, why don't you take that one on? I suspect you've looked into this sort of thing.
Well, you know, we don't know what they're spraying, and so it's hard to say. It might be an insecticide. It might be a fungicide. And there is a very good likelihood that as, you know, those bees are going to be exposed when they're out there foraging. Even if that application happens at night, there's a chance that during the day it might still be causing exposure. Then those bees are moved to another farm and they're pollinating another crop. And, you know, and actually Dr. Kegley should probably speak to this. You know, she went out afterwards and found out what chemicals were in those, were, you know, were those bees being exposed to after a season of foraging. And so Susan, I'll let you talk to that because it's something you've worked on very intimately.
Okay. Ginger, probably what's going on is fungicide sprays. The pear orchard owner is probably paying to have the bees there, and so they wouldn't be spraying insecticides. But the fungicides that are used during bloom are not acutely toxic to bees. In other words, they don't kill them right away. But one of the things that we're just learning in the last 4 or 5 years is that these fungicides can remove the bee's ability to detoxify other chemicals. And so it makes them much more vulnerable. It amplifies the toxicity of other pesticides. And we did a study with some commercial beekeepers in the almond groves in California, and we're finding that there's very strong correlations between exposures to fungicides and the ultimate strength of the hive over time. So it wasn't an acute effect, but it affected the queen's ability to lay eggs and make more bees. And, you know, it affected the survival of the brood. So, like Ame said, you know, these residues are, they get in the pollen and the nectar, and they persist for quite a while. So that's probably what's going on in the pear orchard.
Ame, how much do people appear to be embracing integrated pest management, which uses pesticides as a last resort?
You know, there are so many farmers that want to be doing the right thing, and it's hard to say what percentage of farmers out there, but we're seeing more and more people every day. We don't have the resources to provide the information to everyone who wants to know more about how to limit their pesticide use, how to increase, you know, biological controls, using insects to control other pests instead of using chemicals. So I think it's a growing field. It's also, you know, but it's going to be hard. If you're out there and you're making a living and you have a system that to you works, it's not easy to go and hawk that system for something else. So growing, but there's still more interest needed.
All right. Much more to talk about down the road. We will end it here today, though, talking about protecting pollinators, which is the name of the session on Saturday, Protecting Pollinators, Benefits for Ecosystems and Food Security in Oregon. It is brought to the Rogue Valley on Saturday, the Extension Auditorium on Handley Road by the Pollinator Project of the Rogue Valley, OSU Master Gardeners, the Ashland Food Co-op, and Beyond Toxics. Thanks to Susan Kegley and Ame Code for joining us today on The Exchange. Good to talk to you both.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much.